MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
No! Oh my God! How could he do that?
Are you on drugs? What?
Charles Darwin.
The nerves is where it's at.
Welcome, everybody, back into Nerd Sesh. As always, I'm Carson Brever, and alongside me virtually this time is Logan Camden. That's right, we are back in our respective home states. But fear not, because the content will still be coming in droves. We did just take this past week off, so we've got a ton to get through today. And that's in terms of reacting to what we just saw in the second round series and previewing what's coming up in the conference finals. So without further ado, Logan, let's just jump into it. We had a couple of game sevens yesterday, both kind of shocking in terms of their final outcome, just when you talk about the margin and the nature of the victory, I would say. Let's start with Mavs Suns, Logan. What were your biggest takeaways from what ended up being a 33-point Mavs win? It was 45 with just like 3 minutes remaining.
If I had to pick my biggest takeaway from this game, it's kind of just the coronation and the crowning of Luka Doncic, legacy-wise. We already know how great Luka is. He's been putting up 28-9-8 on better-than-league-average efficiency since he was 21. He's a three-time All-Star now, three-time All-NBA, likely all of them first-team after this year's team is announced. All that regular season stuff aside, though, I mean, this is how superstars' resumes and legacies are built in NBA history, in the playoffs. And I'd say if we look in these past couple years, Carson, the only younger new superstar to actually climb and ascend and actually get to the top of the mountain was Giannis last year. You know, I mean, you have Jokic, two times MVP. He has one Western Conference Finals run. Embiid, back-to-back seasons being a consensus top three player, no significant playoff run. You can throw Trae Young into the mix with his Eastern Conference run. But it's looking a little more fluky as time goes on. So, I mean, just to put this into context, I mean, how many guys his age have beaten a 60-win team? Like, this is kind of unprecedented, right, in the playoffs. Like,
right.
I mean, I look through this, like, you know, you have the 2011 Bulls recently, like the 09 Celtics, but, like, nobody you can point to, you know, did this at this age, this young, this impressively. And, I mean, talking about if we're looking further to the next round, how many superstar guys his age have gone or won the finals? LeBron at 23 takes that shitty 07 Cavs team to the finals, and then Magic wins the finals his rookie year but has Kareem. So, I mean, Luka really could be in a class of his own if he somehow gets this Mavs team to the finals if we're looking ahead to this next series. But, I mean, that is my there's a lot of Suns talking points that we're going to get to in a minute. I think the biggest takeaway that we should have from this is I think this is Luka's official coronation. I mean, me and you have been on him for a long time, but finally something concrete to cement himself as the league's newest, best young superstar.
every step of the way, Luka Doncic has been historically great. I mean, he was on the fringe of the All-Star conversation as a rookie, and the raw production was sensational. The efficiency wasn't there yet. And then he was, I thought, the best 20-year-old player ever. And then he got even better in his third year, his 21-year-old season, improved his consistency as a shooter, added more of his post game. And now in year four, it's like for a while he was down, but since late January, he's been playing his best basketball ever, I think. And I don't know that there is a more complete scoring and playmaking engine in basketball right now. He is absolutely brilliant, top five in the world in both of those categories. So incredibly complete as a scorer on every level, getting to the line, out of the pick and roll. He is an absolute genius and is a completely transcendent passer, clearly among the top three guys alive in that category, and just as complete of an offensive engine, not just as there is in the NBA right now, but as there has ever been, right? I mean, he walks into 28-9, and in his playoff career is 33-9-8 on pretty damn good efficiency, 59% true shooting, I think, around there. That's what he's doing in these playoffs, at least. So his career is 58.4% true shooting in the playoffs. It's just remarkable. He is the kind of guy who is obviously among the absolute best players in the world in the regular season, but has an ability to ascend in the playoffs because of his imposition and I think his versatility in how he can dominate you. Because, yeah, he's going to run a ton of pick and roll and whatnot, but there are so many different ways he can dissect you. And he can go after mismatches out of the post, and he can turn on just absolute playmaker mode. And when he's knocking down 50%+ of his step back threes and the turnarounds are falling and whatnot, I think he's the best offensive player on the planet. And I've been saying that since last year. I don't think he has quite the consistency in terms of that difficult shot making, because you look at his career overall and he's a sub 34% guy from deep, right? Like, he's been 35% the last 2 years, but nevertheless, at the volume he shoots it, sometimes it comes and goes a bit because he takes some really difficult shots. But when that is completely clicking, and we've seen that more often than not in the playoffs, like he's a better than 37% three-point shooter in the playoffs overall. I mean, he just completely dominates and controls the game physically, cerebrally, as a scorer, as a playmaker, and I think makes a really solid case for best offensive player alive. And this is a miraculous feat, dude, because we can look at a lot of the stuff that went wrong with the Suns, and obviously it was an off night from just about everybody, and you have to give some credit to the Mavs defense for how uncomfortable they made CP, and we'll have to get into that, and his kind of just collapse as this series went along, which was just inexcusable in terms of his production. But this is a completely Herculean feat, and obviously the production says that, right? I mean, he had 27 points in the first half. He now has two of the three highest scoring halves in a Game 7 since 2015, because he also had 29 against the Clippers last year. Like, the level he gets to is just unfathomable. But you look at this series, and the Suns were the ultimate complete team, right? They were the juggernaut. They were a 64-win team in the regular season, and there were times where it looked like they were going to be closer to 67 with not that much time left in the regular season. When Devin Booker played, they were 56-12. Like, this was a bona fide powerhouse. We were talking about where they stood among the best regular season teams in recent years. They were top three on both ends. Their depth was tremendous. I thought they had the best cast of role players in the league, and they had two legitimate all-star, possibly even all-NBA level guys. And of course, this wasn't Luka alone. The Mavs played really well defensively. Brunson and Dinwiddie came in huge in this specific game. But throughout the course of the series, the only truly consistent thing was Luka. Far and away the most brilliant aspect, of course, was Luka. And if you just look at the quality player quotient, right, which becomes so important, if you just think about the Celtics-Bucks series, where that was basically the determinant of it all, is, yeah, the Bucks had the supernova, superhuman, best player alive guy in Giannis. And the Celtics still had a superstar, but certainly a tier below in Jason Tatum. And yet, the Celtics won simply because they had more impactful guys. They had more options defensively. They had more creation offensively. And they won as a team, and they overcame the individual. This series is the opposite of that. Even though the role guys came in huge in moments for the Mavs, if you're picking the top five players in this series, I think there's a very legitimate case that, I don't know, maybe four of them are on the Suns. I think there's definitely a case for Brunson over Ayton, and I honestly might even take it just in terms of Brunson being so much more skilled and having a more distinct skill set. But at the same time, Ayton was 18-9 in these playoffs on really good efficiency, and we know what he brings to the table defensively. And I certainly think the Suns would have the next three best guys. And so it's just really remarkable when one guy can do what Luka has done here. And that's not to diminish what the Mavs did defensively, what their role players did in this specific game. But the guy is a behemoth. He is a one-man wrecking crew, and he is among the absolute best players in the game. And I truly believe the best offensive players we have seen in a very long time, probably just all time period. And we'll see if he continues to get better. It seems impossible, but like, he's done it every year. I think that this is the best he's ever been now.
I think it is the best he's ever been. And I think you did a good job kind of summarizing the context of how big of an upset this is. I mean, yeah, you know, you can point to the win totals. You point to all the talent that Phoenix has and how great they've been working together this season. The thing that always is going to bite them in the heel, and I'll give you major props right here, Carson. You deserve a lot of praise for it. Early on in this season, I mean, I want to say we were 2-3 weeks deep, bro. You talked about the difficult shot-making aspect of the Suns, the kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like the improvisation ability of like this Suns team. And when things are, when it's chaotic, when you get down to moments like this, when things are really difficult, when shots aren't falling, there aren't a lot of tendency breakers here in Phoenix. There aren't. I mean, there's CP and there's Book. And when things are off, you have Jay Crowder off the catch, you have Mikal Bridges with a bit of a turnaround game, a floater game around the free throw line, and you have, you know, what, an Ayton turnaround? Like, there's just not a lot of difficult shot-making up and down this roster. I mean, there's a Landry Shamet, but it's like the Mavs had, in my opinion, I mean, I thought CP was off. So after that, I mean, Dallas has three of the best four difficult shot-makers in this series, and I mean, we just saw that as this game went along. Brunson and Dinwiddie. You say what you want about Spencer Dinwiddie, man. He's one talented damn basketball player. And when he's on, Dinwiddie can do stuff like this. And yeah, I want to give, you know, major credit to Luka, because there really is a talent deficit. There's a talent mismatch. That's why all the stupid experts like me and you were sitting here on our high horses talking about how the Suns were going to run through them, just because they are. Like, I would have told you were fucking nuts if you would pick the Mavs in seven or something like that. I never thought this would happen, but I do think in this Game 7, the Mavs had the difficult shot-making advantage, and it kind of showed itself. You know, Mavs burned down the shot clock repeatedly during every single possession, just like, just making the Suns sweat, man, making them bleed, making them look at the score and realize how bad they're getting that ass whooped, and then Dinwiddie and Brunson went to work in isolation if Luka wasn't out there. I think that was probably the distinct, that was the biggest distinction between these two teams, though, is you can have the star power, you can have the great co-stars that work so well together in Mikal Bridges and DeAndre Ayton. At the end of the day, I mean, I do think the Mavs had the difficult shot-making advantage, and I think it was just kind of, it was magnified a little bit more because of Chris Paul, you know, clearly hampered with something. I don't think Chris Paul was healthy.
Yeah, and I think that is actually really a key in this series, right? It came down to shot creation and shot-making because the Suns just didn't have enough options there. And sort of my philosophy throughout the regular season was, well, if CP and Book are on, then you don't necessarily need more than that, right? CP controls the game so phenomenally, amplifies everybody around him, and when he needs to, can be that assertive, high-end scorer. Book is going to fit into the flow of an offense, but also score and play make at a high level. And then it's like, great, let's just have a great cutter and spot-up shooter in Mikal Bridges who can attack closeouts. Let's just have a good role man who's going to score efficiently within the flow in DeAndre Ayton and catch and shooters around those guys. But you see in moments like this, Book is completely off and had one of his worst games of the season, tied for his second lowest scoring output all year. And Chris Paul, regardless of his health status or whatever was going on, was X'd out of the equation. Over his last five games in the series, I believe he averaged 9.4 points and 5.8 assists per game. He didn't even have the playmaking impact because he's not even creating an advantage. And that passivity, yeah, maybe there's a health factor there, but also I do think part of what we've seen is that CP excels so much in hunting specific matchups and going after the weak link as much as possible out of the pick and roll, and then just getting to his spots, and it's okay. I've got my pick of this little slim menu of options, the money, mid-range, you know, maybe I've opened up a playmaking gap and I can take advantage of that. And this Mavs defense, I do think, is relatively difficult to exploit in that there isn't a lumbering big on the court at any times. They switch a lot, and so they're trying to force you into attacking one-on-one. We saw him go after Luka early on in this series, not as much as it went along. And so CP effectively became nothing close to a star-level player offensively, and then they don't have the creation anywhere else. You know, you're right. There isn't the potential for a miracle Jalen Brunson, Spencer Dinwiddie 30 piece. Maybe it's not even a miracle. Like, those guys are just liable to do that. Not often, not super consistently, but they have the shot making and the shot creation skill set for when everything is falling. That's an option. Obviously, we saw Bridges have a really big game with Book out, but overall, the Suns just don't have that kind of additional creation on their roster. And I do think that's something that came back to bite them here. And it's, I think, a fundamental question kind of about the structure of this roster, because if CP can't consistently get to that level, and it's so tough because there were times when it was, wow, this guy's unstoppable. He went 14 of 14 to close out the Pelicans. I mean, he obliterated Luka in game two. But it's a matter of consistency, and I don't know. We've seen it now where he just doesn't always get to that level, and maybe there's just not enough overall offensive firepower on this roster accordingly.
Yeah, I think that's the next – I mean, that's kind of the next logical conversation to have. I do want to delve into Game 7 specifically a little more, but, I mean, the next conversation to have is about Chris Paul and where he's at. And I don't know, man. I don't want to say he's washed, but I think you and Jason have opened my eyes. Another shout-out. Do it every time here. Go listen to The Volume, Hoops Tonight, Jason Timpf, Carson Breber. Really good basketball content.
Hey, thanks, man.
The big differentiation between, you know, stars who are on their way up and on their way out is consistency. And CP has not had it a lot of this postseason. I mean, we saw it during the Pelican series with Book out. We saw it here definitely to close out this series, and we've seen it consistently during his career. I mean, Carson, what is Chris Paul's legacy to you now that we've seen? I mean, they flashed this graphic up at the end of the game. It's very damning on Chris Paul's career. Series lost after leading up 2-0. 08 Western Semis versus the Spurs. 2013 first round versus the Grizzlies. 2016 first round versus the Blazers. Obviously the NBA Finals last season. And then now these semis versus Dallas. Like, I guess what I'm asking you is, I mean, are you looking at Chris Paul's career any differently after this series? And what is his overall legacy?
I would say not really, just because it's so hard, in my opinion, to really actively hurt your legacy when you're still playing at a high level as a 37-year-old. At the same time, this is the best that this is the best team that Chris Paul has ever had. I mean, just point blank. And there were so many times where he did get to that level. So if it isn't a health thing, then it is just really inexcusable. I do think you can look at a bunch of these individual instances, though, and he's not at fault, right? I mean, 2008, he averaged 24 and 11, and it's just like, well, he was so clearly a tier up from everybody else on the floor on his team. And I think about last year, I mean, he was pretty consistently phenomenal outside of that Lakers series when he literally couldn't shoot the ball, and he's just scored with such stunning efficiency overall. I mean, he was 22-8 in the finals last year on 55% from the field, 52% from deep. So it's tough for me to draw those kind of broad conclusions about him because, I mean, he has consistently actually reached a higher level, I feel like, in the playoffs in terms of asserting himself more as a scorer. This feels like the exception. This feels like the time where it's point blank, he sucked. You know, I don't think you can say that in other spots. I think that maybe the team results weren't there, but CP did what he had to do individually. These last five games, he was not close to a star-level player. And again, it's like at 37 years old, how much can that hurt his legacy? I don't know, but this was the chance. This was the team that had it all come together and everybody on their roster improved and they were coming back from a finals run anyways and they won 64 games and they had the coach of the year and it's just like this was the moment. They had a solidly favorable path, you would have thought. I mean, I think they would have been favorites against the Warriors to me if CP got up to the level that you expected, which he just didn't here. And he has to bear the responsibility for that 100%.
I know we talked about this briefly in one of our group chats. I mean, so you think officially, I got your answer last night, but I mean, you think officially this title window's done?
Yeah, I do. I think that it's just tough for me to see the Suns getting better and everybody around them is going to. I mean, we're going to have the fully healthy Clippers again next year. I think we're going to have a really similar Warriors team, but with a fully realized Jordan Poole for an entire year and maybe a more consistent Klay Thompson. And we're going to see, I mean, this Mavs team can really only get better, right? Like, because so much of what they've done this year has been team defense and Luka and then Brunson and everything else has been kind of spotty. Absolutely. The Nuggets are going to be a major player. The teams out East are damn good. And so it's just like, Chris Paul is going to be 38 by the end of next year. Like, what he's doing is already unprecedented historically, but this to me feels like kind of a red flag in terms of, yeah, maybe you can't be a consistent volume offensive star at 37 years old and 38 years old when you're a 6 foot tall guard. And the Ayton dilemma is a big one. Like, I don't think he's close to a max level player. At the same time, he is a very good big man, and he's one of their four best players. And regardless of what you think about paying him that kind of value, which I don't think they should do, I think he's probably, you know, maybe in the $20 million range, it sucks to lose an asset like that for nothing. And although we saw JaVale and Bismack play really well in, like, replacement-level big roles, I still think that they're losing something in terms of touch that Ayton provides. I still don't think either of them are quite the athlete he is. They're not quite the defender that he is. So that would be painful. And then I don't think that they have, again, as we've talked about, that additional shot creation elsewhere. So I think the Suns will be really good next year, but this to me felt like the year for them to win the title, and I just can't quite see them getting back to this level.
I don't want to look too far ahead, and like I said, I want to get back into the specifics of Game 7. So, I mean, me personally, I would look for a replacement level big. They're going to have like 25 mil to play with. And I agree with you on a lot of points. Like, I was a big, like, Ayton hater throughout this year. But JaVale is not the defender. He does not have the awareness that Ayton has. Like, Ayton is a damn good defensive five. He doesn't really make a whole lot of mistakes. He moves well on the court. Like, Biombo and McGee just do not have the defensive instincts and intuitiveness that Ayton has, and I think that's the biggest loss that comes with Ayton. And, I mean, you get into it on the block. He's a big, tough, strong guy, bigger and stronger than both of those guys, and he's got better touch. So I do think they're losing out, and I think Ayton is a very good player. I also agree he's not a max guy. They're going to have about 25 mil to play with, Carson, this offseason. In your opinion, is finding is re-signing Ayton or finding another big man the most important thing, or finding another shot creator for this roster to, like, supplement what Chris Paul doesn't give you? What's the most important need for this team this offseason?
Well, I think that it's a matter of value when it comes to Ayton. I think he's really important to what they do. I think, yeah, if they had another big-time shot creator, if they had, you know, a truly high-level sixth man, if they had a Jalen Brunson who could bring the scoring and playmaking, or if they had a really physically imposing high-level scoring wing, those kind of things would take them up another level. I just don't know, where is that guy on this market who you're getting for, you know, like, who isn't a true star who you would have to manufacture some sort of big deal for who really moves the needle? Like, I just don't think I see that guy as I look through the free agents for this year. I feel like it kind of has to be Ayton, just out of he's going to be the best guy still at a position of need. What do you think?
And I'm sorry, I misspoke. I don't want to spread misinformation on the internet. The Bridges extension kicks in next season, so they're actually going to have more like $7 to $10 million to play with. So, I mean, honestly, if they want to bring Ayton back, you're probably looking at moving Shamit, Saric, and or Crowder to make that
happen. Well, no, because they'll have they'll have his bird right so they can go over the cap.
So they, yeah, I mean, but do you really think that, I don't know, dude. The Suns are just notorious for not wanting to do that. I'm just a little skeptical. I think they'd opt to maybe move some money around. But if they want to compete, they'd have to do that. They'd have to dip into their pockets. I got a follow-up then. Yeah. Aiden asks you for $25 mil. Are you paying him?
I wouldn't want to. I don't think he's worth $25 million. But I don't know, actually. It's tough because it's like you lose the asset for nothing, right? So you may have to, but that's more than he's worth. I will say that.
Mm-hmm. I do want to get into the weeds of Game 7. I also want to apologize to my faithful Suns fans back home in Phoenix. The second Luka hit both of those two step backs, I kind of got jittery, and I immediately threw on my Luka Doncic Real Madrid jersey. Tough. And I think I kind of put some bad juju on the Suns because then the Mavs just didn't start rolling. They just started killing them. A couple things in this game. So call me a crazy person, Carson. I actually went back and rewatched the entirety of this game because I couldn't sleep and I was bored, and I really wanted to see what the hell went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
First off, my issue with the Mavs defense. With the Suns defense. I don't know why they kept trying to do this. Damn near every possession in the first half, or as this game went along, they kept trying to double and trap, and they got caught with an open man damn near every time where Luka spotted, and it was a wide-open three or it was a wide-open layup. And I get you want to speed up their offense, you want to get a steal, you want to get a turnover immediately. The Suns did not help themselves in any regard with some of that. A lot of the possessions doubling and trapping. And, I mean, honestly, everybody's kind of beat this one dead. Really just uncharacteristic misses. Aiden just missing jump hooks, putbacks. Booker literally getting to his spots consistently. I thought early on in this game, I was like, Book's just going to snap out of this. He's getting good looks. He's getting open shots. He's getting to the rack. Stuff just didn't fall. CP3 was just kind of losing his handle. McCall missing uncharacteristic turnarounds and pull-up Jays. Jay Crowder is kind of the sole exception here because in my notes I wrote missing jump shots, and then I put parentheses normal. Jay Crowder just kind of always is missing jump shots.
Or he's I do want perfect. To.
I think I have an award to give out, Carson. This might be the biggest L in the history of Nerd Sesh I'm ever going to give out. Jay Crowder, I give you a friend of the show, Cammy's favorite player, Mr. Boss Man. I'm giving Jay Crowder a lifetime L for getting blocked by Davis Bertans.
Wow.
He got blocked by Davis Bertans, Carson. They swing it to him on the wing and off the catch, and you see Bertans kind of out of position. Jay goes to drive on him, and he thinks he's got him beat. Bertans recovers pretty well and stuffs him, and it's just like Davis Bertans is the single worst defender I think I may have ever seen with my own two eyes. Like, Bertans jumped an inch off the ground, maybe, and stuff Jay's shot. And so I just want to say, Jay, this should be the lowest point of your life. That was embarrassing. So yeah, I'm giving Jay a lifetime L for getting blocked by Davis Bertans. Also, I'm giving the entire Suns roster an L for letting Marquese Chris hit a three on them.
Reasonable.
I do have a question, though, Carson. Was it weird to you? Did you think it was weird that CP3, Book, and Aiden weren't down there 40? And the only reason I asked this, they asked Monty this a little bit in the presser, and he kind of alluded Aiden not playing because of, like, some front office stuff. They didn't want him out there on the floor. It wasn't his decision. To me, Carson, just as a competitor, and I play, you know, fucking intramural basketball and pickup, I don't care how bad the deficit is, and especially with my season on the line, I would just want to be out there. Did you have any reservations about them not being on the floor, even though the ass-whooping was so bad?
No. Devin Booker played 37 minutes in this game. That's more than enough when you're losing by 40.
Book's the exception. Book played all of the third quarter and a lot of the fourth.
But CP played 30-something, right?
Yeah, CP was getting buckets in the third.
Aiden played 17 because he was benched.
At a point, bro, I just feel like I'm sending Book out there and I'm getting him to just pull threes the rest of the game.
I don't know. Personally, I think it's pretty deflating. And at that point, when you're in a game like that, it feels like it's going on for 8 hours. I don't really think that that's an issue at all. That's my take.
Fair. That's all I got on the Suns, bro.
Yeah, well, I will say, that was Davis Bertans' second block of these playoffs that you're talking about. So some other poor soul at some point was also blocked by Davis Bertans. Yeah, I think that this is brutal. This is crushing. They were my pick to win the title. They were your pick to win the title. They felt like the best team in basketball for a majority of this year. I had to kind of come around to that. I mean, I would say I was relatively late to get on the Suns are the best team in basketball bandwagon. They should be the title favorite. But I eventually did get there, and now I kind of wish that I hadn't, because this was really a brutal missed opportunity. This is tough for, honestly, the legacy of everybody involved, because you don't just lose to a team that you're more talented than and that you had the 2-0 advantage on and that you were at home against in Game 7. You get brutalized and humiliated, mm-hmm. and nobody plays well. And you do that after people were already kind of preying on your downfall because of some of the arrogant stuff. And I will say, I was happy to see the Mavs win. Like, I just think they're a more likable team. You know, Luka has his stuff with the refs, and I understand how that could get on people's nerves, but I actually do like his personality. I think he's charismatic and fun and a dog, and he's just an incredibly beautiful basketball player. And the Suns, I don't like Suns fans. I'm going to be honest. Despite, you know, calling Phoenix my home for much of the year, Suns fans are really annoying. They act as if everybody has been praying against them for all of time, and it's just very clear that they've, you know, never won anything meaningful, dare I say, because it's just like every time anything good happens, it's, oh my God, I thought we sucked. I thought we were the worst. I thought we were a joke. It's just like, fellas,
you guys are a joke.
Okay, well, that's a bit cruel, but we'll see how they can extend the life of this core with Book and Bridges and Ayton. But I do not see the title ceiling without Chris Paul at playing at a really high level. I mean, he is the conductor, the maestro, and they need a lead playmaker. As much as I love Book, he is not a lead playmaker offensive engine. And as much as I love Bridges and his role, he is not a star offensive wing. So we'll see. Why are you making that face at me?
Carson, are you saying that Chris Paul fell off?
Towards the end of this series, yeah.
I think he needed that.
I think he needed that too. We'll see how they come back. But major credit to Luka and the Mavs. We'll come back to them later in the show as we look ahead to their conference finals coming up. Let's talk about the other game that ended yesterday. Celtics-Bucks. Obviously, the Celts come through in 7. Logan, they overcame just heroic Giannis efforts throughout this series. But obviously, I think the Middleton absence ended up being too much there. And the Celtics are a great team. So what are your biggest takeaways from that?
My sole biggest takeaway from this, I'll go two, and they both are centered around the coaches. One, I thought Ime Udoka kind of proved to me and to the world why he deserved to be coach of the year. I don't know, man. The midseason turnaround coupled, you know, they have the best defense in the league. They're the best team in the NBA the second half of this season. The adjustments they made mid-series, and I do think this is a bit circumstantial. I think this would have been a slightly different series with Chris Middleton. The Bucks are way more competitive in this Game 7, at least. My biggest takeaway, Carson, and I want your gauge on this as well, does Coach Budenholzer need to be fired? Like, some of these decisions were just head-scratching to me, Carson. I get he get the title last year, but as we get further and further out from that, I question how fluky it was, because you cannot have a discrepancy like this in shooting in a Game 7. You're going to lose this 10 times out of 10 because of his stupid-ass drop coverage. They get outshot 55 threes to 33 threes. Even worse than the drop coverage is, why is Brook Lopez out there so much? He plays 37 minutes in this game. The Bucks, I thought this was fair to anybody who had 2 eyeballs. The Bucks are far better. We're far better in this series when Giannis was at the 5 and they were switching everything, when they let him anchor the defense and Brook Lopez was not on the court. Don't get me wrong. Brook Lopez is a good basketball player, and I like what he does. And at times, I mean, he's a part, he's not this season, but he's been a part of the reason why the Bucks have had, you know, the best defense in the regular season, or one of, these past few years. Every single possession, Grant Williams had a open fucking three.
Yeah.
Brook would not slide. That's why Grant had his career high in points. I love Grant Williams to death. That is my guy. All of Grant's shots were open, and they were just like, yeah, okay, we'll let him shoot it. Guys, this is the fucking NBA. I'm not at the SDFC like, oh, I'm not going to pick up my man because he's shooting 20%
this game.
That's the Sun
Devil Fitness Center, for those of you who don't know.
Yeah, where I ball very often. You know, you can get away with leaving a guy open for five straight possessions over there because we're all bums. This is Grant Williams, and I get it, man. He's a short little stocky 6'6 dude. He can wet up, and he did. Mm-hmm. In every single possession, Brook Lopez is out there not sliding, just getting cooked. And, like, don't get me wrong. I don't know if this adjustment, I don't know if any big changes lead to a different outcome in this Game 7, right? Because, again, you got outshot 55-33 from behind the arc. Giannis's teammates shoot 3 of 29 from deep. Again, Giannis is creating them open looks at every single turn, and they are just not pulling their weight. But I just, I don't know, man. If the Bucks don't get a title last year, I think this would be the nail in the coffin. You know what I mean? Like, how many times can we watch this same story happen over and over again? I just don't want to see this happen next year, and I don't want to waste another prime year of Giannis, who is, I agree, the best player on the planet now. Yeah. Like, this has just been a consistent issue with Bud, and to me it is unsustainable, because every single year you were going to run into, I don't know, man, it just seems like luck, you know what I mean? The Celtics have this identity, they have the best defense in the NBA, and I can rely on it every single night, and they're so switchable and so versatile. And the Bucks, it's like, we have to outshoot them every night if we want to win, or Giannis needs to just pull us across the finish line, and that just, to me, is not sustainable. And I just wonder if Coach Bud needs to be fired, or there needs to be some major adjustments here, man. Are you in the same boat as me, or am I kind of going, am I overreacting to this a little too much?
So, I think there were some issues with Bud, because it's not just the drop, right? It is the insistence on taking away the paint blindly at all causes and at all costs, and the aggressive overhelping. Because you said it, dude, Grant Williams took 18 threes in this game. That is the second most of anybody in a playoff game ever. Grant Williams. And not a single one of them felt forced, I didn't think. There was not one where I was like, hey, Grant, you probably shouldn't be shooting that. I mean, maybe cumulatively, if he was missing, you guys would say, okay, Grant, settle down. But in a vacuum, all of those are good looks. And that's just kind of wild to me. When you go down letting him get 18 open looks from three, and you let up 22 threes overall as a team, and it's because you are fundamentally structured to do that. And you're not eliciting, you know, some of the early possession pull-ups that you would be okay with, right, where the ball isn't moving and whatnot. No, you're getting driving kicks to open shooters, and the pull-up jumpers are falling from, like, the lead guys. Tatum was knocking them down, and it's just like, okay, I guess we'll just lose like that. That is bad. Brook Lopez playing as much as he did is bad. At the same time, a couple things. First of all, I think this series looks very different with Chris Middleton. I think the Bucks win this series with Chris Middleton. I mean, they went seven with two legitimate shot creators who had to take on massive volume. I mean, what Giannis had to do here was superhuman, with so much defensive attention devoted to him. What Drew had to do also, just in terms of effort and volume, was pretty darn significant. And everybody else around them is basically a catch and shooter, like just role players, guys who are built only to play off of the offense that's created for them. You inject a guy who gave you 24 a game last playoffs, who is an efficient 20-plus point per game scorer consistently, and a brilliant three-level scorer, an incredible difficult shot maker, and good playmaker, and just great release valve and clutch guy, and your second best offensive player, point blank, that totally changes the dynamics, I think. So that's part one. They were able to make it a damn good series without that, because Giannis is God. I also think he's the best player alive now. I think that that's difficult to dispute, honestly. Go ahead.
That is just one thing that I disagree with. Is, I mean, I think the Celtics get this done in six if Marcus Smart isn't a complete fucking bum in game five. Like, yeah, it's close, but the Celtics blew a couple of these games late. Like, yeah, I guess I agree fundamentally. I do want to get into game five, though. I've got, because we were off for so, like, we haven't done a pod in like a week, right? Like, since we were back out in Phoenix. I got a couple of gripes in these games that I want to get onto, but.
Okay. Well, let me just say, my second point with Bud is that although he is flawed, you're not just going to find a better coach elsewhere. Like, that's the reality of it. Guys who do not have head coaching jobs do not have head coaching jobs for a reason, largely.
So, I mean, does it fuck with you at all that, I mean, Bud's set in his ways. He's an old school guy. He's an old coach. He's not going to change now. Like, okay, let me ask you a different question. Are the Bucks the best team in the NBA with Chris Middleton?
This year, I think they probably would have won the title.
I mean, we both had them going to the title game. It's just like, I don't know, man. Bud isn't going to change this up, and I just feel like it's... I guess I just feel like this team could be better when it comes playoff time, and there's just more variables because of how Bud plays basketball. Like,
I agree, but they're not getting Giannis Spoelstra.
They're not getting Nick Nurse if they hire a coach. I know Bud's a good coach. Bud's won Coach of the Year. He was under Pop. He coached those Hawks teams. Like, I know Bud's a good coach. I just want him to stop being so rigid.
I agree.
Old school, man.
I agree. He's stuck in his ways. This has been the narrative with him forever. But alas, the grass is not always greener. And he has issues, but I think he's a less flawed candidate than whoever else they would be looking to.
Fair. Looking at this from the Celtics, I do want to talk about Marcus Smart's disaster class that was Game 5. Oh, my God. I mean, I put that loss all on him. I put that loss solely on the shoulders of Marcus Smart. He should not have been out there. I would have had Peyton Pritchard. I would have had literally anybody else out there on the floor. And it's like, that's kind of the ebbs and flows and the beauty and the ugliness of this Celtics system, right? It's that Udoka is going to draw plays that involve involve everybody. If it's setting a pin down screen, if it's setting an off ball screen, if you are solely just tasked with taking the ball off of an inbound to the corner and then getting it to Tatum. There were like, just to slow down. So there's two possessions in Game 5 where Marcus Smart just dribbles the ball like off his fucking leg and loses it. Mm-hmm. Embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Just embarrassing. He has no handle. There are another two possessions late in this game where Marcus Smart goes and takes a shot. I think he's instructed to off of a design play where Jason Tatum does not touch the ball at all. That's a cardinal sin. Late in games, I want Jason Tatum touching that rock during a possession no matter what. I want my best guy getting his hands on the ball. And then there's just like him just missing shots. Like, I don't know what the lead was. I didn't take down the notes, but I can tell you from just watching Game 5, Celtics should not have lost that one. Marcus Smart choked that game away, and it was embarrassing. Did that stick out to you as well, Carson?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. It ended up obviously not coming back to kill them in this series. So, but yeah, it was really bad. But I don't know. I feel like at this point, I am more intrigued by what's next for this Celtics team. What are the keys for them?
I agree.
But you just had to get it off your chest about Marcus Smart. Sure. Oh, sure. I understand.
We just need to pull receipts and we need to hold guys accountable. While we're on that, because I do think looking forward is much more interesting, because we've been off for so long, we didn't react to Game 6. Masterclass by Tatum. That's not exactly, like, that fourth quarter was just amazing. It's not what I expect out of Tatum. I don't think it was some. Everybody came out and was, oh, you know, this is crowning. He's officially a superstar. I wanted to smack all those people in the jaws and just be like, nah, man, Tatum's been doing this all year. This is what Jason Tatum is like. Like, Jason Tatum is him. He's just like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. And no, I don't expect the guy to go 7 of 14 or 7 of 15 from deep every game and close out games like that. But that turnaround off the inbound, 2 seconds on the shot clock on the baseline, inbounds it right to him, shoots over the top. That was beautiful. The sidestep threes, the step backs. Again, I don't expect that out of Tatum every night out, but damn, it's beautiful when it all connects because that's Tatum at his best, and he is that special of a scorer, and I'm just so glad that we were able to see it in a big stage where everybody can finally go, oh yeah, Jason Tatum's like that. Again, I think there are differences, like, you know, I don't want to put him in a class with Luka, I don't want to put him in a class with Jokic, with Giannis, with... But Tatum is a very special scorer, and I was glad that we get to see a classic Tatum performance in Game 6. And then, yeah, my guy Grant Williams goes ballistic in Game 7. Just to recap those last three games, but I had to get that Marcus Smart mess off my chest, bro. Marcus Smart sucks, and sometimes if he's... Carson, I get a sense with Marcus Smart when I'm watching him play, like, oh my God, Marcus is about to shit the bed. Like, we need to get him off the court. Like, I have an innate sense with Marcus when I know stuff's about to hit the fan, and you could tell it in Game 5, bro. It was like quicksand where every play he was just fucking up. And there's not like there's a wealth of on-ball creators. It's like, who am I taking Marcus Smart out to play? Oh, yeah, I'm going to get some Nick Stauskas minutes? No, there's not another ball handler that you can turn to late. But, yeah, man. Marcus Smart is a deeply flawed offensive basketball player.
Yes. There's nothing to dispute there. I mean, you know, the sun also shines every day. Like, he is as wild and erratic and mind-bogglingly dumb at times as anybody offensively. But you live for the good stuff.
That's very cute, Carson. For the viewers that can't see, because me and Carson are on a FaceTime call right now, this dude just fixed his hair on camera. Yeah, everybody's going to see it, man. You need to get your comb too, bro.
Well, I can see myself. And so I'm just trying to figure out how to make the best use of this recent haircut that I got. So when it comes to Tatum, yes, absolutely. He's been at this level since, you know, the past few months. I mean, we talked about it post-All-Star break. He was better than 31 a game, I think, on like 65%+ true shooting. And his playmaking and defense has all come such a long way. I think he's a top-tier NBA superstar. Like, you know, the amount of guys I would take over him is no more than 7. I mean, honestly, right now, I think he's been playing basketball at a higher level than Steph Curry. Out of this playoff field, I would take Giannis and Luka above him. And out of guys who are not here, I would still take LeBron and KD and Jokic and Embiid. But I think that that's it, unless I'm forgetting anybody. And, like, that's just a remarkable ascent, and he's certainly good enough to be the best player on a team that wins it all. I think that we saw some of the issues offensively with the Celtics in this series that always concerned me, that I thought early in the year were the reason that, like, they were literally doomed to just never contend. When you talk about the lack of that table setting, tempo setting, floor general presence, that lead playmaker, and their tendency to at times fall into, okay, one-on-one, difficult shot making. That stuff did present itself here, and yet they still came out on top. So I don't know. I think that the Celtics have a very legitimate title chance, and I don't have a ton else on this series, except I think that Giannis has proven that he's the best player alive. I mean, he walked into the toughest matchup possible without his second best offensive player on the floor, and regardless of the efficiency, he went out there and averaged 34-15-7 and was also playing defense at an all-world level. Like, it's just next-level stuff that nobody else in the NBA could do.
Yeah, I completely agree. The final thing I'll add on the Celtics flaws that we saw, you and Jason also touched on this, and I thought we saw it in Game 6 and Game 5. I put that all on Marcus Smart in Game 5. And I think it's worthwhile, but Boston was doing something typical that we've seen a lot of them in that series, and that was shooting early in the shot clock, shooting bad threes, missing, and letting the Bucks run in transition. And it almost came back to bite them, but they did fix that in 6 and 7, and I thought that's why they clutched out. But Game 5, that was definitely a big reason they lost too, and something that Boston is not going to be able to do against Miami. Again, like, Miami's not this dominant transition team, but, I mean, that's just a quick recipe, you know, to play yourself out of a ball game, to beat yourself, essentially. And we just saw that a little bit against Milwaukee, and we can't see that against Miami, or it will come back to bite them.
Yeah, I completely agree on that front, and that remains to me kind of the biggest concern that there is with this team, because other than that, I mean, this is a phenomenal defensive team. It's the best defensive team on the planet. When they're clicking, they have an elite primary shot maker and good playmaker and a damn good secondary scorer and some really nice complementary role players. And, you know, the shooting is certainly good enough. So, I mean, they kind of have all the components. It's just a matter of, I think, the consistency of that decision making and the consistency of that shot making from their lead guys, because I have no questions about this defense any step of the way. And I think that, to me, the Celtics are the favorite against the Heat, but we'll get into that series later, obviously. Let's talk about the others that ended a couple days ago. Warriors-Grizzlies first. The Dubs ended up wrapping it up in six after getting whooped by 50 or whatever it ended up being against the Grizzlies in game five without Ja. They came back and they got the job done. Logan, what were your takeaways from that?
First of all, I'd just like to say Dylan Brooks is pure evil. And I hate that man. And if I see Dylan Brooks in the streets, we got beef, bruh. I just don't like how he be running his mouth. Like Dylan Brooks, bro, you literally shot like, you were shooting like, you were giving me like eight a night on like 20%, homie. Yeah. Why are you talking trash? You're also a dirty POS for what you did to my boy GP2. And GP2 has shooters in the streets, bro.
Us included.
Catch me in the bay, Dylan Brooks. I got beef. Anyway, off that, I have a few questions I'd like to ask you about the Grizzlies in general. First, what does this series finish out like if Ja is healthy?
I think the Dubs still win. I think that maybe it's in seven instead, but I don't even know that that's necessarily true. Because, I mean, I think that as it was all year, you know, the same reason we saw them win 21 of their first 23 games without Ja, there are trade-offs. And I think that this team got significantly stingier defensively, obviously, and got bigger and was able to make life harder on the Dubs in terms of scoring the ball. And they obviously lost something offensively. Like, that's really, I don't know, maybe Ja could have swung the result just because it's like you are counting on Dylan Brooks for so many shots, and he was still doing that when Ja was out there. I mean, the dude took almost 16 shots a game in these playoffs, Logan, and made 35% of them. Like, I don't know where he gets off, man. And he doesn't get to the line. And he's taking two free throws a game, right? There's nothing easy ever. It's just tough shot, tough shot, tough shot, tough shot. 44% true shooting. Wowza. So, I don't know. Yeah, the offense would have come easier, obviously. You would have had the capacity to have Ja go off for 47 like he did in game two and have that monster scoring playmaking impact and just wear down the Warriors defense more. And I don't think they had an answer for him. But at the same time, I don't think it actually swings the result of this series. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I do want to ask another follow-up question, though. I mean, do you think the Grizzlies can win a title with a roster constructed as it currently is?
Do I think they can win the title?
With their roster constructed as it currently is. You know, they don't really add any other big pieces. Can they win a title?
I don't think so. I don't think that they have enough secondary creation. I mean, it's like a guessing game night to night with Triple J and with Brooks, and as good as Bane is, again, he doesn't step in as that lead star second creator. They have one offensive star, point blank. Nobody else comes close. So regardless of what you think of Bane as an all-around player, or Triple J as a two-way player, or just the strength of their depth and their identity, I just don't think they're talented enough fundamentally at the top end. What do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't think the Grizzlies are far off in the sense, I think they need one more like shot creator. Honestly, the caliber of a Dinwiddie, a Brunson, a Reggie Jackson. And what I mean by that is a guy that can, you know, like I allude to the, to Reggie in the playoffs, what he did with the Clippers. I think they need, you know, they just need another shot creator that can get hot in a playoff run. And I think they can make a Western Conference Finals run. But I do think there's a gap. It's kind of all I got on Memphis. I mean, on Golden State's part, I just want to give them credit for all the hustle we saw from them in Game 6. They out-rebounded Memphis 6 offensive boards to 1 in the first quarter, 12-4 in the first half, 11-3 in the fourth quarter, and on the game, 25 offensive boards to 10 on the game. Kevon Looney, shout out, bruh. Like, 11, The simply put, the Dubs do not win this game without what Looney did on the glass. 11 boards in the first quarter, 22 on the game, 11 offensive, 11 defensive. Shout out to Wiggins, too. He was not having a good game in the early goings of this, missing jump shots early, kind of just off. And then just that one hustle play, I think it was just an offensive board where he got a putback. And I was like, all right, Wiggins, let's turn up. And then he's crashing the glass hard the rest of the game. He was taking good shots, and he hit a couple in rhythm. Wiggins played his ass off after a slow start to this game. 11 boards, 6 of them on the offensive glass. And then, of course, you get Game 6 Clay Carson. Oh, my God, dude. He had me jumping up and down in my seat. Lily, my younger sister, was watching the game in the seat behind me, and I say watching in quotation marks. I just kept turning to her and going, Lily, do you see what Clay Thompson is doing right now? He's going the fuck off. Masterclass by Clay. I didn't even expect this. But I think the Dubs are probably my title favorite right now, Carson. What about you?
Man, that is an exceptionally difficult question because every team left is so interesting this year, and it feels like as good as all four teams are, they also have such distinct flaws in their own ways, right? Like, the Celtics, again, you still question at times the consistency of the decision-making offensively and of just the control and composure there. I think with the Heat, you also question the half-court offense and just, okay, well, Jimmy needs to be kind of superhuman. He needs to keep playing at the level that he's been at, and we'll see what level of creation they get elsewhere. I do feel like, in some ways at this point, the Heat might have, I don't know, I think that my concern about them in terms of them just like falling off has diminished, but I also still don't feel like they have quite the ceiling probably of the top two teams in my mind, which would be Golden State and Boston. And then you look at the Mavs, and it's really just, I think, a matter of a talent deficit and the consistency of their lead guys alongside Luka. The fact that they have one star and nobody else approaching that conversation. The Dubs, I don't know. It kind of feels like maybe they deserve to be, because when everything is clicking, when they are playing at their best level defensively and Poole is knocking in 25 a night and Clay is shooting the ball well and Steph is who we expect him to be, that does feel like the best team that there is to me. But there are still issues, right? I still think that when it comes to size, although I don't really know who's exploiting that at this point, actually. I don't know if anybody is going to attack any issues they have there, really. Luka will be a problem for their perimeter guys, but I think you probably put Wiggins on him as much as possible and just try to go from there. But it does feel to me like the Warriors still have a little bit of a different level to get to, and it's really just a matter of Steph being Steph. You know, we saw it for times in the first round series, but against the Grizzlies, he was 26 a night, 41% from the field, 33% from deep. That's just not typical Steph Curry. I mean, he is just not creating individually at the level that we have normally grown to see from him. And I don't know if that should be the expectation that continues, because that was kind of the reality throughout this regular season, right? There was just a dip in shot making and production, certainly compared to last year, but compared to just typical Steph as well. But at the same time, you think Steph Curry and like some of just the pure shot making stuff has to level out and he'll be transcendent there, you would think. So I kind of feel like them and Boston are my co-favorites right now. I might take Boston though. I feel like Boston might just be a little bit more talented, and I think what Boston does defensively is kind of in a different tier than the competition right now. I don't think the Warriors can get to that level as good as they were for so much of the season. Like, they just don't have that kind of size and athleticism and switchability and completeness. And that Boston, I mean, they have, with Rob Williams healthy, 7 damn good defenders. Like, really, really good defenders. They barely have to play anybody who is not a damn good defender. And, you know, there's an old saying where I come from, Logan. Offense wins games. Defense wins championships. And although I do believe offense is actually the more valuable thing in today's NBA, and, you know, a lot of defensive stuff can be comprised of effort and whatnot, I just think the Celtics are the best defense that I've seen in a while. And Jason Timpf, my guy, has been saying that they're the best defense of this era, the best defense that he can remember watching in his life, and that's like excluding the 04 Pistons, but you know, late 2000s probably through today for him. And I don't know that I can really think of a better defense. Like, they are really, really exceptional. So I don't know. It's them or the Dubs for me. They're very close, but I think I might lead Boston. But again, the Warriors ceiling with Steph playing at like peak Steph level, I think that's the best team.
Yeah, and I think that's the distinct advantage that they have over other teams, is I just trust the wealth of creators that they have. You know what I mean? Like, JB and Tatum can have a bad game, and then who are they turning to? You know, you need Grant Williams or Al Horford to come through. I trust Poole, I trust Curry, I trust Clay a little more to just create, and I think that might be the distinction. I do agree with you. I think the Celtics are the best defense that I've seen in a while. And if there is a marker to go to in recent playoff memory, you know, that points to a championship-winning team, it is defense. You look at last year, the Bucks and the Suns, two best defenses in the league, get to the finals. Lakers, year previous, and the Heat, two defense best defenses. I mean, so if there is a marker to look for when it comes to playoff time.
Year before that, the Raptors were probably the best defense in the league.
Exactly. I mean, so I think that's why it sucks going against Boston. I might even pick against Boston in this upcoming series. Call me a wild man. I don't know, dude. I really am up in the air about these last two series.
Yeah, that's interesting. And again, I don't think any of these teams are without flaws, so none of that is like inconceivable, but we'll get back to that in a second. Let's quickly wrap up the last series that we saw conclude. Heat Sixers, Logan, what were your takeaways from the Heat advancing, the Sixers going down in appropriately embarrassing fashion?
My biggest question was kind of just, you know, how much blame does Embiid deserve? I don't really blame Embiid at all for this one. I think you can point to what happened last year, and I think that's a bigger stain on his resume, losing to Trae Young. Injured, I mean, he's clearly hampered by these collective injuries. Two posts up in Game 3, two posts up in Game 4, one post up in Game 5, and in Game 6, through two quarters, he had four posts up with no field goal attempts. And, I mean, you can look at those numbers, and that, I think, points to him being injured and changing his game. Mm-hmm. He also just, bro, when he was shooting, he was, you know, putting up knuckleballs, like air balls, just uncharacteristic stuff from Embiid because of the thumb injury. I don't really put a whole lot of this on him. I put this way more on Harden. I blame Tyrese Maxey a little bit for Game 6. You know, just kind of chucking deep shots late in the shot clock, just not really getting anything to fall. But, I mean, I think you got to put the most of this on James Harden. Shoots 9 field goals, has 11 points, 9 assists, scored 0 points in the fourth quarters of Game 5 and 6. And, I mean, you've all seen the numbers. These are courtesy of StatMuse. Second half, was putting up 5.3 points on 5.3 field goals attempts on, you know, 28-25 splits. So, yeah, James Harden shit the bed. And I think, I mean, my biggest takeaway is just James Harden is never going to be the player that he once was. I think that's kind of, that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
We knew, I mean, we predicted that during the midseason. But, I mean, it's not even just what he does on ball. James Harden does nothing for you off ball. He does, you know, provide zero effort when the ball is not in his hands. And he doesn't do anything else. And I mean that defensively, too. And I think the most telling possession of this series, of what James Harden has become, has to be that Jimmy Butler play where there is an offensive rebound opportunity for Miami. Jimmy misses a shot. And Harden could have easily sealed off the baseline and gotten a rebound and pushed in transition. But instead, Harden didn't. Harden did not push. He did not get the rebound. He did not push in transition. Instead, James Harden chose to let Jimmy Butler get that rebound. He chooses to fade off of Jimmy instead. He does not D-Jimmy up in the corner. He kind of gives him like a foot of space, and Jimmy drains the three in his mouth and, you know, mouths wow as he gets up and down the court. And that was just very telling. This is your lifeblood. This is your season on the fucking line. And you decided to not chase after an offensive rebound. You chose, instead, you didn't go up for that offensive board. And you didn't defend his shot. You let Jimmy shoot right in your face. You let him hit it, and you didn't try. You just gave up. And I think that's the most telling play of James Harden's career and where he's at in terms of effort. I don't care about what he does offensively because he's not the same offensive player. But in a closeout game, you don't go after a crucial rebound. You don't play defense. You let Jimmy wet up in your mouth. And that, to me, was the most telling play of this series of James Harden's career and where he stands at as a basketball player for me.
Yeah, this is brutal for Harden. This is brutal for Embiid, and this is brutal for the Sixers. They were point-blank the more talented team here, and that's no disrespect to the Heat, because the Heat are very good, and they've been very good. But this was a phenomenally talented Philly team in theory. And I just think that clearly, as you said, Harden is not the player that he was for so long. That's undeniable. And it honestly looks wrong to me that he even averaged 22-10 this year, although that's so far behind what he did 2 years ago when he was dropping 34 a night. That was 2 years ago. When they made the move to get him, I thought, hey, in the right situation, dialed in, healthy, this guy can still be an offensive juggernaut. He can be the missing link, right? The Sixers have always needed that true star perimeter initiator, the guy who can take pressure off of Embiid, who can feed into Embiid's game, who can take over scoring himself and set the tempo for the game and all that. And Harden ended up only being able to do bits and pieces of that. I mean, his playmaking presence, his composure, his pace, all of that stuff is still there, but he simply is not even a high-level scorer of the basketball anymore, which is crazy because he scored 36 points per game 3 years ago and 34 points per game 2 years ago. But, like, there is no burst. There is no ability to actually get by people. And so what his game basically is relegated to is putting up threes, right? It's step backs, pretty much, is what he has. And then occasionally he gets into the lane and throws up a floater. But, like, he just doesn't exert pressure on defenses anymore, which is crazy because it's a catastrophic decline. And I don't know, maybe he gets better again next year, but, like, I don't think that there's a ton of reason to expect that. And that just is devastating because now he's, like, a fringe all-star level player. Like, I mean, he was below that in these playoffs, but I'm saying going into next year, that's kind of what I expect. He feels like he's around the 30th best player in the league or something, which is crazy.
Yeah, I think I'm in agreement with that. I think expecting Harden to come back and be something different is kind of out of the question. I think you'd be a fool to think that. And I also think if we're looking back, would you still pull this trigger? Now you have handcuffed yourself to a $47 million contract next season. Granted, he'll be off the books. Personally, I'd rather have probably Seth Curry and Andre Drummond and whatever, you know, fake asset Ben Simmons is. I don't know. Mm. I mean, would you still go back and do that trade, Carson? I probably wouldn't at this point.
It's tough to look at it as a win, I think, given just the dramatic underachievement and the contract that you are going to probably force yourself into, because I mean, the max thing is such a dilemma just because it's like you can't lose the asset for nothing. Maybe somebody else is going to pay him the max, but I don't know that anybody is. I mean, to me, he's a guy you want to pay like 20-something million, maybe 30.
Yeah.
That's James Harden's value right now, and he's going to regress further because, you know, you're locking him up at 32 years old. So, I don't know. At the same time, Ben Simmons was a zero for you, so that's difficult. But maybe you could have gotten something at some point. You just don't know. Like, I think it's tough regardless, though. What is undeniable is James Harden has had a fraction of the positive impact that I thought he would even at the time that they made that trade, and that's devastating for them.
And just to pile on, final thing on this series, I just want to say, James Harden let himself get outplayed by Max Strus and Shake Milton in a closeout game. And, that's about it. He let himself get outplayed by Max Strus and Shake Milton in a closing game. That's all that I need to say.
Yeah, and regardless of Embiid's health, I think he has to be responsible here, too, just in terms of the lack of production. I mean, he's sub-20 a game on sub-43% from the field. Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't know. I didn't think that his effort was overly impressive, and I think that, I mean, he did, I thought, have an impressive defensive impact in the first couple games he was on the floor, but then I thought that that regressed, and I don't know. It's almost hard for me to just be like, wow, James Harden, James Harden, James Harden, when this is what he had been for 20 games. You know, it's like, We didn't have a reason to expect James Harden would be better than this. He went well over a month without scoring more than 23 points in a game.
Yeah. I did think that the Sixers were just kind of purely more offensively talented, and I thought that's what was going to carry them through. I am not surprised that this is what we get out of Harden, though.
No, I don't think you can be at all, but it just sucks when it's like Tyrese Maxey steps up and is the leading scorer in this series and just balled out throughout the entire playoffs, like such a big-time performer, 21 a game throughout the playoffs on good efficiency, and it's just a bummer that, you know, Harden obviously couldn't be what was expected, and Embiid health wasn't there and the production wasn't there when he was on the floor. So, and obviously, you know, Tease had just a brutal showing here, offensively inept, to where he wasn't even able to play like super big minutes overall in the series. It's just an overall disaster. And props to the Heat. I mean, obviously great team defense, balanced offensive attack. Jimmy Butler is playing at a superstar level in these playoffs. He is 29, 7.5, and 5.5 on better than 52% from the field, better than 36% from deep on actual like solid volume, getting to the line a ton and making 81% of his attempts. Like he is just phenomenal. He's playing at a phenomenal level right now. So with that, let's talk about what's next for the Heat, because they've got the Celtics now. I think certainly a better team and a different challenge, but what are your expectations for that series, Logan?
I expect it to be super gritty, man. I'm excited, Cards, and this is kind of the outcome that I wanted. I am kicking myself. I believe I said this on a podcast previously. I did bet out the Heat. I am still kicking myself for that. Again, I think there are flaws to this team, like we have touched on. But, man, I might go Heat in 7. And I think the distinction that I'm going to go with here, I think this is going to be a dogfight. I think this is going to be a damn good series. I trust the Heat role players a little more, and I think that matters at the end of the day. I trust the Max Struces of the world. I trust the Gabe Vincents to just to make plays, man. I trust Victor Oladipo to make plays. I think this is going to be a... I wonder how many games teams are going to crack 100 points, Carson. I mean that. Like, I think this is going to be a nasty, nasty series. I think it's going to be a throwback. And don't get me wrong, the Celtics have that same kind of punch from their shot creators. And they've got guys who play their roles pretty well. But I think the Heat have more Swiss Army knives. I think Jimmy and Hero are a really good offensive tandem to combat Tatum and Brown. If Tatum goes supernova for this series and he balls out, I don't think the Heat have an answer for him, but I don't think we're going to get Tatum supernova every night. I think Jimmy and him are going to go head-to-head, and I think we're going to get some good Hero nights. At the end of the day, I think these teams are evenly matched defensively. I don't think Miami's as good as them at their ceiling, but I think the Heat just have like more depth of talented offensive players, and I think that's why I'm going to give them the edge. And I am so mad at myself for counting the Heat out, but things have really broken their way, and I think Miami is going to the finals like I predicted in the preseason.
Wow. I think I'm going to go Celts in 6. I'm caught between 6 and 7. Honestly, maybe I'll go 7 just because it does feel like they're very tight, but that does mean they would have to win a game 7 on the road logistically, which, you know, that's just pretty darn difficult to do. But I'll go Celtics in 7. I think that, simply put, I think that their defensive ceiling is a major advantage, and as good as the Heat are defensively, I don't think that they have an advantage in terms of offensive firepower, really. Like, I don't know if I necessarily agree there. I think that Hero, as good as he is an inefficient and inconsistent second option, and I think that Bam obviously isn't going to consistently impose himself as that offensive force, and it's just the stuff that we saw throughout the year, right? Like, sure, if Jimmy averages 28 and 6 on insane efficiency, well, maybe that changes the dynamic, but that feels like a lot to ask against a Boston defense that has so many sensational options on the perimeter, such great athletes, and Jason Tatum, who right now is just point blank one of the best wing defenders on the planet, and Jaylen is a damn good wing defender too. Like, there's just
that's fair.
So many counters there, and it feels like a bit too much of a load for Jimmy to carry. And then outside of that, it's just like, I don't know, man. Major props to Max Strus, but he's not exactly going out there and creating a ton of his own buckets, right? And I just don't know. I mean, Hero throughout these playoffs has been sub 14 a game on 42% from the field, 27% from three. He's just not that true offensive star. There are nights, there are plenty of nights, but I don't know. Against this Boston defense, it just feels like they're going to be labored to create. And I do worry about the Heat kind of lulling the Celtics into some bad shots and some bad stretches. Like, I think that's legitimate because they have really good personnel and we've seen those tendencies from the Celtics. But I just think the Celtics are better defensively. I think they have the best player in the series. I think that they have more true high-impact guys. And so actually, back to Boston in six. I'm going Boston in six. As I've kind of talked this through, I feel like the gap is maybe a little bit bigger than you do. You know, if the Heat have a great shooting series, if Jimmy plays lights out, and if they can force the Celtics into some bad decisions and Tatum's a bit off, they can totally win this. But I do feel like the Celtics are just a better team.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should not be taking, I shouldn't be taking the Miami offense for granted, because this is a tall task. And in a tough shot-making battle, I guess I do trust JB and Tatum more. But I don't know, man. I guess I just trust that dog that Jimmy's got in him, man. I think Jimmy is going to show up this series.
I would just be concerned. I just think Boston has made such superior offensive players so uncomfortable. I mean, like, we've never seen KD made uncomfortable.
Oh, no, dude. I mean,
like,
they've made...
was.
We've never seen Giannis. I mean, like, this is what, like, a worst, you know, percentage from Giannis that we've seen. No, I agree. This is not a, no, Carson, don't get me wrong, my friend. This is not a prediction based in logic. Good. This is a prediction based in, like, faith. I think Jimmy's going to show up, and I think he's going to carry him over
the top.
That's
interesting.
And I think this is going to be a nasty series.
It is. Oh,
man.
It's going to be gritty. It's going to be a grind. There's going to be some ugly offensive nights. Okay, so outside of Jimmy, who are the most important players to actually pulling this off for Miami?
I mean, the other wing defenders, I think Victor Oladipo is another massive, massive part of swinging this series. He's going to be tasked with, you know, D-ing up VO, excuse me, D-ing up VO, with D-ing up JB, Tatum on certain possessions. I think Tyler Hero is obviously massive. He is going to have to pull his weight here. You need 20 points a night from Hero to win this. You know, 18 to 20 a night, and there can't be any excuses. He's got to pull his weight. And then I think the role guys have just got to play well, man. Lowry has got to knock down his catch-and-shoot attempts if he's out there. Duncan Robinson, depending on how much PT he gets, I've noticed that they've opted to go with Strus more. I honestly don't hate it. I think Strus brings you a little bit more of playmaking, ball handling, getting to the cup, getting out in transition, and I think he's a better defender. So I'd say Strus and Robinson in terms of just making open jump shots and making good decisions are important. And then, of course, Bam. And I think Bam it's tough, man, because I don't really know if they have an answer. Like, PJ's important too. Damn near every guy's important in this series, but whoever they stick on Horford, because Horford is a killer, man. In terms of backdoor cutting for rebounding, that's such a small facet of the game. Dude, Horford's just so smart. And so just somebody being able to, honestly, just like keeping an eye on Horford and not making him make, we've seen, I mean, momentum shifting putback dunks from Horford in this game. Crucial, crucial offensive rebounds in that series against Milwaukee. So I think whoever draws Horford, I'd say most important, Jimmy, obviously, Hero, VO, and then I'd probably say Bam. Mm-hmm. In terms of Miami pulling this out. Like I said, man, this is not a logic. I do think Boston is probably, I think Boston's a better team. This is an argument based in faith, and I think the Heat are just going to do it, man.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't think that I necessarily agree, and I don't know that I agree when it comes to trusting the role guys and the supporting pieces more either, because I mean, I believe in the shooting of Horford and Grant, and yeah, Smart, obviously it's up and down, but at the end of the day, he's a better overall player than a whole lot of Miami's role guys. So it just feels to me like, although both these teams can be inconsistent offensively and neither of them are perfect, The separator is the Celtics defense. It really is. It's the Celtics defense and the fact that they have the lead shot making of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. And there is such a cohesion and an effortlessness with which they dominate the game defensively. And they just take away what you want to do. They take away your primary option and they close gaps and they just do everything at such a high level. So I think that I laid out what Miami can do to win this. And to me, it kind of feels like if Boston doesn't shoot themselves in the foot, if they don't fall into long stretches of bad decision-making, of poor shooting, of Tatum being off, of Jaylen missing playmaking opportunities, that of Marcus Smart forcing the issue, and they are liable to do those things. I just don't think they're liable enough to where I would pick Miami when I think they're flat out at a talent deficit. They're not as good of a two-way team, and I really don't think I trust them more on either end. I don't think they have the best player. Like, there's just, I think, a lot of things working for Boston. I still think it's going to be a dogfight in a close series, but I feel pretty good picking Boston. Any other thoughts on this series?
Yeah, two words.
Yeah.
Give me Jimmy.
That's three words. Yeah, all right. Well,
gimme.
Check the dictionary for that one, buddy. I don't think you'll find it.
I don't even know how to respond to that, bro.
All right.
Corny ass MF. Right.
Let's look out west. Let's look at west. What are your expectations there? What's your pick?
I mean, I'm obviously going with the Warriors, but hey, dude, I think the Dallas Mavericks can beat anybody.
Yeah.
I really do. I think, and honestly, in terms of imposing their will and physicality, I think Boston's probably the most physically imposing team left, just because of Horford. You know, you get a strong guy like Grant. Tatum's pretty physically imposing, and Rob. The Mavs are going to. It's going to be an interesting fight down there on the low block because Dwight Powell and Kleba are. They're good, strong, sturdy guys. Don't get me wrong. I think it's going to be interesting. Like, I think Looney, I think it's going to be a battle down there, but I don't think they can get bounced around. But I think the Mavs can compete with the Warriors in terms of, like, in just pure shooting, dude. Luka is damn near unstoppable. He's going to get to his spots. And then I just expect Brunson did. I expect that guys to just shoot well and play their roles. Like, mm-hmm. I do think the Warriors are a better team, clearly. I just think there's a different defensive level that the Warriors can get to that Dallas doesn't have. So did Phoenix, and it didn't matter. And I don't think we're going to see the Warriors crumble. I just think the Warriors are way more composed. They've had experience of being here before. I think they have more shot creators than Phoenix. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's why this is a drastically different series. I'm going to go Dubs in six. But is there a little more Luka magic that we could see? Mm-hmm. If Steph has a bad series? If Jordan Poole has a bad series? Fuck yeah, there is. I can 100% see Luka getting to the finals in seven.
Yeah.
I'm not going to bet on it, though. I'm taking the Dubs in six.
I'm going to go Dubs in six. You could talk me into Dubs in seven because Luka Doncic is going to win you two games in any playoff series on the planet, pretty much. Like, I genuinely believe that. And he is going to dominate the series. I do not think there is a counter. I do not think there is a matchup that can take away from that. The Warriors do not have, that elite one-on-one perimeter defender who you're going to stick out there. Draymond is a really good perimeter defender. Wiggins is a really good perimeter defender. But Draymond, obviously, you want him playing basically every role. Like, I don't think they're going to dedicate him to Luka for the entire series at all. They might dedicate him in stretches. He can be a great counter when Luka goes inside or, you know, if he's trying to attack out of the post and whatnot, although I don't know that he would do that on Draymond. He might only do that against true mismatches. But regardless, it's just like Luka's going to get his. And I think it's about, okay, as the old saying goes, let's turn him into a scorer. He will score 35, but let's not let him create, 25 open threes for his teammates and give us 15 assists a night. Like, that's just what you can't tolerate, because other than that, I think the Mavericks' secondary shot creation is too inconsistent. I think it's too spotty for me. Brunson is really good, but he's not a true second star. And Spencer Dinwiddie, was shooting 36% before he suddenly had 30. But I just don't think that's sustainable enough. And then on the other end, I think it's about just really getting Steph going. Again, I think that Reggie Bullock is going to be tough. I mean, he's a guy who fights and he's, physical, he's tough, and what? Logan's squinting at me. I don't know, dude. I don't know that we should just give Steph the default, oh yeah, he's going off no matter what treatment right now when he hasn't been doing that and he's going up against a really good perimeter defender. But I do just believe more in the secondary creation. I think that they have... I think I like their depth more. I mean, I do like Dallas's depth, and I think their role players have done a good job playing both ends, but I think I trust the Warriors more. I think Poole has the potential to be the third best offensive player in this series. I think Klay has the potential to swing a bunch of games. I think, you know, I just think they're better. I think that they're a better basketball team, and it's tough for me to see how the Mavs win this. Well, no, I can see it. It's Luka absolutely insane, which feels like kind of a given. Phenomenal shooting around him. Brunson Dinwiddie go off. That's it. And it's going to be tough to stop the Mavs, but I also think the Mavs are going to struggle to stop the Dubs. And it feels to me like if everybody on the Warriors does their job and plays up to expectations, they should win this. But it is scary. Luka is that damn good. And we saw it. He just has to get within striking range, and all of a sudden it's okay. Well, what if the Mavs have a great shooting night and Brunson and Dinwiddie do go off? Then boom, you're done. So you can't play around. That's for sure.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just want to say, top five basketball players of all time. Here are my rankings,
Reggie
okay? Number one, Henny Jr.
Okay.
Number two, LeBron. Number three, Hoodie Mello. Number four, Spencer Dinwiddie when he's feeling himself, nice. All right? You don't want to let Dinwiddie feel himself, Carson. That's when you get in the danger zone, okay? Mm-hmm. Look, man, I do think Dinwiddie's going to come out hot, bro. He's had back-to-back hot shooting nights, what, 30 pieces? I think game one or two, Dinwiddie's going to have a big night. All that being said, I agree largely with all of what you said. I mean, it would just take a crazy unforeseen downfall from the Dubs and an absolutely torrid hot series from the Mavs. So, I'm taking Dubs in six. But, yeah, I mean... There is a route. There's always a route when you get this close.
Yeah, Spencer Dinwiddie is shooting a sparkling 39.7% on two-pointers in these playoffs.
He's like that, bro. He's like that.
He's a tough bucket, bro. I like Dinwiddie, but it's just like it's so ugly.
No, you don't. Don't lie about that, bro. My dad still talks to this day about that time you were slandering Spencer Dinwiddie.
Bro, do you remember the first year that we did a podcast when he was on the Nets? And he was carrying that team without Kyrie, and he was putting up like 22-7, and they were like a playoff caliber team. I advocated, I'm pretty sure, for him to be an all-star at that point, or he was my first guy off. I was a huge Dinwiddie advocate, but at the end of the day, like, it's just never consistent or efficient enough. Like, yeah, when he's going, it's super fun. He's a difficult shot maker, but he's also a difficult shot misser. He misses a lot of them.
No, I get that. I just want to say, Carson, Dinwiddie came out, and he hit two threes, and during that game, my dad goes, man, why was Carson talking all that shit
hilarious.
On Dinwiddie?
Well, Jimmy, it's because he was shooting 36% before that game. But yes, he had a wonderful performance. Second most points off the bench in a game seven ever.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on this series? Any other keys that stand out in your mind?
Off that stat, as a podcaster, I thought I'd never say that. Say this. I'm at a loss for words.
Well, you should actually check out, Logan, the Volume Sports TikTok, where you can find five fun facts, five crazy facts from the Game 7s that we just saw, because there's four more where that came from, and my smiling face is delivering all of them to you. Man, I wish we had video of this. Logan's face is so close to the camera right now, so unbelievably close, and he's got a crazed look in his eye, and I wish I could just bottle it up and sell it because it's beautiful. All right. Well, there you have it. There are our predictions. I'm taking Celtics in six, and I'm taking Dubs in six. Logan is taking the Heat in seven and the Dubs in six. We've reflected. We've looked forward. And that's really all that we do here, isn't it, at Nerd Sesh. So if you enjoyed the content, the good news is that there's plenty more like it. Check us out everywhere, baby. Check us out on TikTok at Nerd Sesh. Check us out on Instagram at Nerd Sesh. Twitter at Nerd_Sesh. We've got... More new forms of content coming for you guys soon. We've got updated logos. We've really got it all. Check out the podcast wherever you get your audio content, baby. It's playoff season. Check out Hoops Tonight with Jason Timpf and Carson Breber, all right? Check out all of it. If our faces are on it, then you want more of it, and you better believe that. So, yeah. With that, as always, I've been Carson Breber.
I have been Logan Camden.
And this was Nerd Sesh.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.